This is the Jewish News Podcast, in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group, supporting Jewish communities worldwide. I'm Justin Cohen, and coming up on this special edition of the programme. As Jewish communities around the world prepare to mark Lord Sachs's first yacht site this Monday night, and ahead of a major event in London in November, we examine the legacy of the former chief rabbi and how his teachings continue to inspire well beyond the Jewish community. He was a Jewish rabbi, but he was also a rabbi for the universe. His teaching grounded in Judaism, but never constrained by it. I regard him as my rabbi too. I know he will continue to inspire future generations, Jewish or not. Those were the stirring words of Tony Blair last week, when he took part in the first Sachs Conversation, a new series of events in his memory. It's hard to believe it's been a year without hearing those unmistakable, velvety tones on Thought for the Day. A year without tuning into Newsnight to listen to his take on the big national and international issues of the day. It's also been a year without being told by Dan Sacker, his long-term director of communications, that he was writing yet another book and that I'd have more chance of getting a quote from the Pope until he finishes. Well, I might be paraphrasing that last part just a little. During this podcast, we'll examine his continuing impact and plans to keep his teachings alive with some of his greatest admirers and those who had the privilege to know him best. I spoke earlier to Joanna Benarosh, the CEO of the Rabbi Sachs Legacy Trust, Alan Sachs, the brother of the former chief rabbi, and South Africa's current chief rabbi, Warren Goldstein. But first, I spoke to the former foreign secretary, now head of the International Rescue Committee, David Miliband. David, you describe yourself as an atheist, so some people may be a little surprised to hear you taking the trouble and taking time out of your schedule to pay tribute to Lord Sachs. Tell us about why you decided to come on today.
Well, you asked me, Justin, and so I thought it would be polite to do so because Lord Sachs was a towering figure in British life, and I had the great good fortune to be able to have really wonderful and enriching conversations with him over about 25 years. Obviously, I put out a statement at the time of his tragically early death, but since you did me the honour of asking to interview me, I thought it would be polite to do so in recognition of the big hole that's been left, not just in British life, but in international life, as a result of the former chief rabbi's passing.
During those conversations you had with him, obviously there was the time you were foreign secretary for a period during his leadership. What were your discussions about? Were they of a political nature, of a personal nature?
We talked about pretty much everything. I mean, I first met the chief rabbi when he was chief rabbi, when I went to work for Tony Blair in the mid-1990s. And I got the chance to meet the chief rabbi and Jonathan Kestenbaum, and I would go around there and just talk to them about the state of the country, the state of the world, the state of ideas, all of the things on which Jonathan Sachs had this distinctive point of view, which was both deeply personal, obviously deeply religious in his case, but also deeply worldly, deeply global, and of real insight, I think, into so many aspects of national and international life. And in the course of the 25 years, we talked about everything from the state of the Labour Party to the state of the country to the state of the football teams. The most recent meetings I'd had with him were at the TED conference in 2017, where both of us were speaking, he with obviously appropriately a higher billing than I, but he made a wonderful speech there about teasing out the arguments that he'd been working on for so many years about what he called the importance of we. But actually the year before, he had come to New York to do some of his teaching. And he gave me the chance. He said, look, why don't we do a conversation together? So at New York University, we had a couple of hundred people, and I had the chance to interview him. It was called a conversation, but it was more of an interview. And it was very Jonathan Sachs, because the meeting itself was extraordinarily erudite, as you'd expect from him. But what has never been revealed until this podcast is that it was the night of a massive Bernie Sanders rally outside the New York University in Washington Square. And the chief rabbi didn't hesitate to vault over police barriers to get to an entrance that was otherwise blocked with cheering Bernie Sanders supporters. And I feel very lucky to have had so many chances to get an insight into the way the chief rabbi thought about these deep issues of universalism and pluralism that so preoccupied him throughout his life.
And did you ever have the chance to hear from or learn more about Lord Sacks, the man behind the genius? Did you see the human side of him as well?
Yes, of course. But first of all, he would have pushed back against the genius labels that are applied. Look, I was a 29, 30-year-old nudnik when I started with him. I was nothing. And he was obviously a professor in all sorts of ways, but he was also someone who asked you what you thought, which was quite daunting. He was extraordinarily influenced, I think, and well, obviously influenced by Elaine and by his family, and the personal side brought such joy to him. But he was also amazingly embracing of Louise and then Isaac and Jacob, our two kids, and he had a deep humanity, I think.
What was it, though, that enabled him to reach so far beyond the community in a way that few other religious figures do beyond their own communities?
Yeah, I hope it's not glib to say that he was obviously a preacher, but he didn't preach, or it didn't sound like he was preaching. He was a preacher who was a conversationalist. And he was also, I think it's also important to say, he wasn't just very clever, he was extraordinarily erudite, and he brought his erudition to the service of difficult questions. And he always gave an additional perspective, a different perspective, an insightful perspective. And I think he therefore spoke to people's lives when he had these conversations, when he was able to go on Radio 4 or write for the Times. I mean, he was able to speak to people through his erudition, but critically, his erudition was not abstruse, and his language was not abstruse. His ideas and his commitments were very earthed, and that, I think, is in the language that he used. And I think that that obviously meant he was a great communicator as well as a great thinker.
Is there anyone else on the world scene at the moment, particularly from the religious communities, but also beyond that, that you see as his successor, if you like, his heir, or anyone like him?
That's interesting. I mean, I hadn't thought of that before you said it, but there, and it's wrong to put them in the same category, but I mean, there's a remarkable man that comes into my head when you ask it, the Reverend William Barber, who is probably not that well known outside the United States, but he runs something, I think it's called the Poor People's Movement. He was the chair of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, NAACP. He has these things called Moral Mondays, and he's someone who I think reaches really beyond the confines of those who are in front of the pulpit. I mean, he speaks widely, but it's an interesting question. You're sort of asking which religious leaders have become public intellectuals in the way that Jonathan Sacks did, and I don't know the answer to that, but it's William Barber pops into my head.
Mm-hmm. And in your many discussions, you say, over 25 years, did you ever have cause, as a result of those conversations with Lord Sacks, to waver in your own atheism, perhaps, even though he wasn't preaching to you?
That was never a test that he or I applied. And so he wasn't seeking to persuade, and I wasn't seeking to persuade. I'll never forget, though, at the retirement dinner that was held for him, where Prince Charles spoke, and he was presented with a beautiful, extraordinary Torah. And he'd already made one speech that evening, quite a long one, and, itself brilliant. But then Prince Charles made his speech and presented to him this beautiful, ancient Torah. And Jonathan came to the platform and said, I will always carry this Torah, but I never forget that the Torah carries me. And I thought that was, well, you can tell it was memorable at the moment. And that just, I think, demonstrated the depth and the significance and was a beautiful insight into the way religious conviction carried him forward. And so I admired that, but it would be wrong to say that it was, I was thinking about it in any sense, trying to persuade that was never where the conversations were. And I certainly am not going to venture into the debates within the Jewish community about how plural can it be. And there is obviously controversy about that. But I was struck how, to me, and as someone who wasn't a believer, Jonathan never made me feel that that affected his view of me, mm-hmm. which is pretty big, really. Mm-hmm.
Did you ever go round to the Saxes for Friday night or for other meals?
I did, yes. And he was very good at including people and bringing different groups of people together. And that was obviously something he did in partnership with Elaine. And you can't think of one without the other, really. I mean, we're such a remarkable couple.
Just finally, in terms of the last few years of his life, he was one of the most vocal people within the community, certainly one of the earliest to speak out very strongly on Labour anti-Semitism. And that's something you did as well. Is that a discussion you had with him at any point?
I don't think so, no. I mean, I'm sure if I would have been just embarrassed about my party, that should even have to be discussed. We must have discussed it, actually, because when I saw him in 2016 or 2017, at the TED conference, we went out for dinner in Vancouver together. And as I say, we did this public session in 2016 at New York University. But I always have said publicly and privately that I never thought I'd ever see the day when the words anti-Semitism and Labour were in the same paragraph, never mind the same headline. And I'm sure it was as abhorrent to him as it was to me that any political party of standing in the UK should be in that situation. But he was also, you know, his warnings about anti-Semitism are well made, and the need for, I think I talked about when I spoke at the Board of Deputies a few years ago, sort of war on complacency. I think that's very important.
And just finally, did he talk to you about your current work and fighting for refugees? Is that a topic that he was keen to talk to you about?
Yes, I don't want to overclaim, but he obviously, in a number of his books, including In God's Name, a book he wrote 4 or 5 years ago, he quoted often, treat the stranger as one of your own because we have been the stranger. And he understood deeply, as to be fair, I think that it was the current chief rabbi who went to Lesvos or one of the Greek islands to meet Syrian refugees. He knew from Jewish history that the way when you treat other human beings as others, not brothers, which is was a favorite Sachs phrase, that's the route to hell. I mean, that's just human hell. That's awful. And he deeply felt that the way persecution and violence and conflict blighted lives was something that Jews and the Jewish tradition have special insight for. I don't think he would have wanted to get into the language of special responsibility. He thought all human beings had a responsibility to defend other human beings. And that's part of the universalism that he brought to his understanding of the human condition from a distinctly Jewish perspective.
David Miliband, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Next Monday and Tuesday, to mark a year since Lord Sachs's passing, communities across the globe will take part in Communities in Conversation, a programme developed by Joanna Ben-Arosh, the long-term head of Lord Sachs's office and now CEO of the trust set up to ensure his legacy lives on. Earlier, I spoke to her alongside South Africa's current chief rabbi, Warren Goldstein, and Lord Sachs's brother, Alan.
Alan, if I can start with you, and first of all, to wish you and the family long life at this time. We know Rabbi Sachs, the great orator, the great writer, the person that's referred to by Tony Blair and Prince Charles and all sorts of leaders around the world. But I want to get an idea of the man behind the genius. What sort of a brother was he?
For the first 18 years of my life, he was so far removed from me, so way ahead of me, it's difficult to describe him as a brother. There was 8 years between us. By the time he was 15 or 16, he was a pure intellectual. He was not interested in all the things that I was interested in, so he wasn't playing football or cricket with us. He was far too busy reading about politics. From when I was a student onwards, and even though we were separated by 50 miles or 3,000 miles, whether I was at university or he was here and there or I went to live in Israel, we were very close and we talked about the things that amused us and we talked about the things that worried us and we talked about family things, about movies and music, about spirituality. I would tell him my worries about the world and he would always uplift me somehow. An incredibly enthusiastic and encouraging person. And then he developed a fantastic relationship with my children and he wanted to know about them and he took a huge amount of pride in the fact he had nephews and nieces in the Israel Defense Forces. But, you know, there was no gap. This wasn't Rabbi Sacks, the dignified, silver, yellow-tied wearing chief rabbi. It was really close and intimate. And he would be fascinated, he wanted to hear from my kids about the latest Israeli pop music or talk to them about real matters of their level. And somehow or other he would raise the conversation, but through the things that interested him. So we really did have a great bond on issues ranging from religion to rap music, just to use the letter R.
You were saying, Alan, that he enjoyed talking about music, and I was thinking about this actually earlier on, because when I last had a proper sit-down interview with him, which was to mark his 70th birthday, he was talking to me about his love of Ed Sheeran's Castle on the Hill and how he liked to run to that particular music. It wasn't the kind of thing that you would expect to hear from Lord Sacks automatically. And then there was the kind of the jokey side as well, the more accessible side, where he spoke at the Night of Heroes, where we honoured him, and told David Walliams that he was giving him a straight path to conversion, which caused the whole room to erupt in laughter.
First of all, just to touch on one of those points, my brother had a fantastic sense of humour. And that is one of the things that perhaps separates him from many of the rabbis with whom I've come into contact here in Israel, at least. He had a fantastic sense of humour. He loved music of all kinds, but he didn't worship music. He saw music as a spiritual or enlivening or enriching medium. So, yes, he thought Beethoven quartets were the most spiritual music that he had ever encountered, save for a nigun. And the power of the nigun was, for my brother, the power that could open the gates of heaven. But he saw the liveliness, the enthusiasm which modern music could bring. And as I say, he didn't worship it as a medium in itself. He didn't worship the lyrics, and he certainly didn't worship the people who produced it. But, you know, later on in his life, he was overwhelmingly enthusiastic about Hamilton because he saw Hamilton as a brilliant medium for transferring a mass of completely uninteresting history about the creation of the Federal Reserve Bank in the United States of America and turning it into a hip-hop feature with black actors and Hispanic actors to make it relevant and pertinent and attractive. He loved some of the pop music that we talked about because of its liveliness. He loved some of it because of its melody. And in the last years as well, he became more and more enthusiastic about Israeli pop singers who were finding or groping for religion through their music. They were trying to find some modern expression for an argument with God or an argument with the political powers that be. Yishai Ribo, Ehud Banai, people who are not singing Hasidic songs, but are using biblical or other themes to tell us a story in the modern medium of, let's call it a pop song. He loved all of this creativity, he loved all of this excitement, and he loved the spirituality all in one.
And Joanna, as a boss, tell us about Rabbi Sacks. Was he playing Ed Sheeran in the office every day?
Not every day. He was an amazing, amazing boss. You went to work in the morning and you had no idea what was going to come up that day, whether you were going to get a phone call with an impromptu share, with an idea that had just come into his head, which was probably the 56th idea that he'd had before breakfast. And he always wanted to know what we thought. He said, are you with me, guys? Do you get it? Does it make sense? Are other people going to get it? And I think we learned from his creativity. He was incredibly hardworking. He pushed himself so hard. People used to say, can you just ask him to speak for 3 minutes? And they didn't understand that whether he was speaking for 3 minutes or 3 hours, whether it was a roundtable discussion or whether it was a lecture to 1,000 people, the preparation that he put into absolutely everything he did was just unbelievable. I used to call him in the summer and say, the local rabbi might be on holiday, would you mind stepping in? He said, Joanna, don't worry, I've always got a spare drasha in my pocket just in case. And that was the level of prep. Nothing was just, he sounded effortless, but to sound effortless, you have to put in an incredible amount of work. And just coming back to what Alan was saying about the music, we learned so much from him about music. He would call us and ask us, are you at your computer? Can you listen to this piece of music? And then he would tell us details that you would have no idea. He wanted a level of depth of understanding about why that person wrote what they wrote, how it was put together. So did you know, I'm going to get this all wrong, but Bohemian Rhapsody was recorded, I don't know how many times, over and over and over again to get the level of sound. That's the level of detail and depth. He wanted to know the meaning behind things. So he wasn't just looking at the surface. He was digging deep to know what was. And we were so blessed to be, to be working for and privileged to be working for someone with this incredible intellect. Every day was a learning experience for us.
And Chief Rabbi Goldstein, the pastoral side of Lord Sacks is, it's not necessarily a word that's automatically associated with him above the oratory and above the writing and so on. But I know that you've written in the past, in the last year, about him being the Prince of Kindness, how he was one of the first people to call you after you became Chief Rabbi. I personally experienced some of that amazing kindness just 6 weeks before Lord Sacks passed away. I was struggling for various reasons, and Dan Sacker, head of communications for Lord Sacks, arranged for him to call me. We had a great conversation. He gave me some advice, told me, things would look better by the spring. And actually, he was right, but unfortunately, he didn't have a chance to see that. We didn't have a chance to go for the walk on Hampstead Heath that he promised me when things were better. Can you tell me about the Chief Rabbi that you saw, the Lord Sacks that you saw, the kind pastoral figure?
Yeah, I think what I saw and experienced myself personally was firstly warmth. It wasn't only about the concern, but genuine warmth. When he was talking, it was engaging a sense of the affection and interest. It came across in a very powerful way. And also from a pastoral point of view, this position of Chief Rabbi is a very lonely job because, there aren't many. And for me, over these years, I've been in the position in South Africa for 17 years. And throughout these years, it started off at that, that first moment when I was appointed, which was actually almost 18 years ago, because there was a year of transition. And he called me, as you referred. But then throughout those years, we spoke often. Firstly, he would always ask about, what I was doing and what was going on. And another thing is that he was always so encouraging of me. He used to, like we're talking here today, it's literally 2 days before the Shabbat project. And, there'll be communities in 1,500 cities around the world, doing amazing things for Shabbat. Often he spoke to me about that. And he gave me so much personal encouragement to say, listen, the work is good and continue to do it. And believe in yourself. And I really got the sense that he appreciated what I was doing and had given it thought and understood different styles of leadership. Because his style of leadership was one style. And, there are different kinds of leadership within the rabbinic world and outside of the rabbinic world. And I think he appreciated that individuality. So he was able to see, different styles and appreciate and acknowledge that and really see it. And there were times that I would phone and just to talk to him about something or to get some advice from him or insight. He was always available. Joanna was the one who always set things, up. So I'm very grateful to you, Joanna, for that over all the years. Such an important part of making Rabbi Sacks available and accessible to people. And Joanna will be able to say how, he came back quickly. And then often as well, I saw it as well, on the times that he came to South Africa as a guest speaker. you know, for the Sinai and Darbar conferences that I put together. And firstly, everybody loved, I mean, he was always the highlight. We would bring out a team of speakers from all over the world, and they would flock to hear him amongst all of the speakers. But also, whenever he spoke, he made sure to give encouragement to me in that public platform, to give encouragement to the South African Jewish community for its uniqueness and specialness. He was never merely there as a speaker to deliver the content. He was always looking at, what's the context here? These are people who are listening. What do they need to hear for them? They need to hear the words of Torah and the words of Hashem's wisdom. And of course, that was his primary objective. But he knew that people were all looking for chizuk, for strength, for encouragement, for acknowledgement. And he gave that to me personally, but he gave that to the community. Like saying to the community, acknowledging the specialness and the uniqueness of the South African Jewish community. So I saw in him whenever he spoke, and it's a lesson that I've tried to adopt for myself when I go to a shul to speak, because I watched him do it. When he's speaking, he's looking at the people and working out, what do they need to hear? What's going to give them encouragement? How can this drasha be held in the context of chesed? It was really Torah with chesed. You know, the way the Gemara calls Torah Chesed, the Torah of Chesed, because, you know, his Chesed was in giving Torah, because he gave Torah to so many people and he had poured out of him. I mean, the writings, the speeches, the wisdom and the depth and the intellectual depth, it just poured out of him. That itself was an act of giving. But then when he did it in a way where you could feel his compassion, his empathy, you see, because a person of tremendous intellect can sometimes be deep in the world of thoughts and disconnected from the world of people. He was deep in the world of people and very sharp and very empathetic to who he was talking to. And I watched him in that interaction. I remember also the time, you know, when he invited me to speak at the rabbinical conference in London to address the Rabbonim. And even that invitation was a gracious invitation. And he encouraged me and you know, we spoke about my speeches afterwards. I met with him before and after, and I just also watched him interact with his Rabbanim, with his Beit Din, and I just saw in so many different ways the empathy, because really, you know, a person who is a gadol is someone who sees the people around him. You know, the Maharal says it on the pasuk about Moshe Rabbeinu at the beginning of the book of Shmot, of Exodus, when it says, Vayigdal Moshe, he grew up physically. And then the very next pasuk says, Vayigdal, he grew up. But in the context of that, it says, and he went out to his brothers and he saw their suffering. And the Maharal says, a gadol is a person who sees the people around him and sees the world around him. So, you know, I think for me, Rabbi Sacks Zatzal was a gadol. He was a gadol, a great human being, a great rabbi. But he was a gadol in the definition of the Maharal. Not only a gadol in Torah, in depth of understanding, but a gadol in human relationships and a gadol in seeing everybody. Because before you can be kind, you have to see the people. You see, the empathy is the prerequisite to kindness. You cannot be kind unless you see and acknowledge and identify with the needs and the suffering of people around you. That opens the way to compassion. Everyone has a compassionate heart. The difference between the people who act with compassion and those who do not is actually goes down to empathy. Do you actually see the people around you? And Rabbi Sacks was a gadol in the deepest sense of the word, because he saw big. He saw the people around him. He saw his impact on them. And he knew what they needed and was acutely aware of it. And then the love and the compassion poured from him.
You're obviously lucky enough to have that same title of chief rabbi as he had, albeit in a different location. To what extent is he seen by you and by your colleagues as the archetypal chief rabbi, the man that will always have to be, you know, you have to follow, or even perhaps that you have to live in the shadow of?
Yes, you know, firstly, it's an interesting thing that you say you're lucky enough to hold the title of chief rabbi. So that could also be an interesting debate, but I'm joking. It's a privilege and an honor, and I'm deeply honored to have been able to serve my community in that capacity. But you know what I learned from Rabbi Sacks Zatzal? He taught, both in his drashot and his books, but also in the way that he lived, and I saw it in my personal interactions with him, that every human being is an individual, and we need to bring our individual imprint to the work that we do. whether that is as a chief rabbi, or whether that is as a rabbi of a synagogue, or whether that is as a doctor or a lawyer or a business person, whether that is as a mother or a father, everyone parents in a different way. Everyone does their work, they conduct themselves, they interact with other people in their own unique way. And, you know, it reminds me very powerfully of the idea from Rav Soloveitchik, Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, where he talks about the Gemara that says that when a person passes away, it's like a Sefer Torah being burnt. And Rabbi Soloveitchik explains it by saying that, he quotes from a Tosfot, but we don't have time to go into all of it now, but that a Sefer Torah has to reflect the individual handwriting of the Sofer. That if one Sofer writes over the letter of another, if the one wrote it in a red ink and the other came to trace over it in the black ink, which is the kosher ink, it would not be kosher Sefer Torah, because it has to be the unique, the halachot of how to write the Sefer Torah, but it has to be the unique handwriting. Every Sefer Torah is unique, every human being is unique. And what I learned from Rabbi Sacks is that leadership is unique. Every chief rabbi has to be unique. He taught that. I think if he were here in this conversation today, he would be the first person to say that you cannot have one imprint of what it is to be a rabbi. You cannot have one imprint of what it is to be a chief rabbi. And you cannot have one imprint of what it is to be a father or a mother or a doctor or a business leader or a community leader. Having said that, he excelled in the position and achieved levels of global recognition, of Kiddush Hashem. When I say global recognition, it's not about recognition for its own sake. It is that he became an iconic figure of Kiddush Hashem, meaning through the power of his intellect and the strength of his speeches and the force of his personality and the depth of his insight, he brought grandeur and glory to the Torah itself. And he did that in a way that is almost unprecedented. And so in a certain sense, if you were to say, and this is clear, a chief rabbi is there to represent Torah in this world and to represent its wisdom and to represent the Jewish people and to be a beacon of light in that. So that he achieved in spectacular fashion and in a way that that shed so much light in the world, which in, I was saying this to Joanna, even in the days after his passing, the global outpouring of his passing, sometimes you almost need to see an absence in order to understand what we had. The global outpouring in this year since his passing has been so profound. Even, you know, here in South Africa, how many people in that week after his passing came over to me and said they feel like they've lost their rabbi, and here they're sitting in South Africa. The impact was staggering and inspirational, and it's something which I think we all take tremendous pride in.
Joanna, I mean, as Rabbi Goldstein just said, even Tony Blair, of course, who isn't Jewish himself, although practically an honorary Jew, I think, at this point, he referred to Lord Sacks as his rabbi. What do you think it was that made him reach beyond the community in such a unique and profound way?
Well, I think that at his core, Rabbi Sacks was a teacher of Torah. But he taught Torah to Jews and non-Jews alike with equal passion and insight and with equal success. He wanted Jews to live, as he called it, a Judaism engaged with the world, one which showed us and the world the integral contribution our faith had to make. And I think more than any Jewish leader recently, he taught us how to live our Jewish values and how to share those values with the world. But I think also one of the things, and I'll probably end up paraphrasing him, he said, non-Jews respect Jews who respect Judaism, right? So he was a living embodiment of what it was to be a proud Jew, but he didn't keep his Judaism to himself or in his family or in his community. He shared it with the world, and those values lit up the world. You know, he really was a walking embodiment of what it was to be a good Jew, and people felt that they could learn from him. I mean, Tony Blair had alluded to it, and on Monday night, the first time they had a proper conversation was on a flight to, I think, Rabin's funeral. And Rabbi Sacks was preparing for that week's sermon or whatever it was. And he had one of his sfarim with him on the plane, probably had more than one. And Tony Blair came over and looked over his shoulder and said, "What are you doing? What is this book?" And he explained to him what he was learning from. And he said, "Well, can you teach me what you're learning?" So he taught Tony Blair Prince Charles was also on that flight. I'm not sure who else. And he ended up giving a shear to an existing prime minister, previous prime minister, and the future King of England. And it spoke to all of them because he made his ideas and his thoughts and his teachings made very difficult and complex ideas easily accessible. And I think it was an incredible gift.
And just to take you back a year before we actually look forward to keeping his legacy going, you must have, apart from, you know, obviously suffering your own grief and loss, you will have been dealing with messages and tributes from around the world, both from within the community and outside. Obviously, we saw what happened on social media on that Saturday night when it was announced, a huge outpouring. Can you give us an idea about the kind of people that were calling the office that day, the following day, and so on?
So Shabbat had gone out in Israel 2 hours previously, and for some reason, the news had got out in Israel before it got out here. And we needed to tell people, and we couldn't actually keep up with the volume, and people were emailing saying it can't be true from literally all over the world. And as America woke up, and in the days after the Leviathan, after the Shiva, which was a very, very difficult time, apart from the terrible grief, it was also COVID, so it was total lockdown. How could we give him the right send-off that he deserved with the right people there? And actually, it was a very moving Leviathan because it was just a close family and a very small number of us there. And the Shiva again, you know, you couldn't have the thousands of people that would have poured through the doors. The United Synagogue had agreed just the Friday prior to his passing that you could have 1 hour Shiva in a shul once a day with 15 people, including the people sitting Shiva. So having the people coming to visit, it was really, 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 really difficult, a very emotional time. But I left that week with personally 400 emails, thousands of WhatsApp messages that took me weeks to plow through. And people were expressing their emotions in their messages that we couldn't actually come to terms with. And actually, I was talking to one of Rabbi Sachs's children during the Shiva, and he says, you always told us the reach that my father had, but we didn't dream it was anything like this. People are mourning as if this was their personal family member, not just a rabbi in the UK. This was someone who touched people's lives. And as Chief Rabbi Goldstein said, you know, when he spoke to an audience, you felt he was speaking just to you personally. He reached in and touched people's hearts in a way that I've not seen many people able to do. But he also graced people's Shabbat table around the world. Wherever I traveled with him around the world, we would go into shul and people would come up to him and say, we learn with you every Shabbat, you are at our Shabbat table. And I think that was a level of interaction, even remotely, that touched people's hearts. And everything that he wrote, everything he said, everything he recorded felt like a personal message to people around the world. And for me personally, he was at our Shabbat table, our chag table, at least at Sukkot every year. And it was such a privilege to host him. And we were so lucky to have that interaction. He officiated at my daughter's wedding, and I will never forget that. But he would call just to check up on us. He got nachas from my children. He was an incredible, incredible person. It was a huge privilege to be in his presence. And I think, looking back, we were so lucky to have him in our lives.
Yeah. I know we've only got about 5 minutes left, and I want to come to Alan again in a moment. But I know, Jonah, you're leading a program of worldwide study to mark the Yahrt site on the 25th and 26th, Communities in Conversation. Can you just tell us a bit about that and how you came to launch that program?
I can. We had planned the Tony Blair conversation, which we called the Sachs conversation, rather than a memorial lecture. And we realized that we were actually focusing on Rabbi Sachs's and his public intellectual moral voice. And really what mattered most to him was teacher of Torah, and how could we mark the Yahrt site by a proper initiative that engaged communities around the world. This year was meant to be a pilot project. So we were going to start with a few communities where he'd interacted, and I reached out to communities that he had personal connection with, Rabbonim and organizational heads that he'd actually met and engaged with over the years. He did a huge amount of overseas traveling over the last few years. And as I started to make calls and email people, and I started with personal calls, I WhatsApped and Zoomed with a lot of communities in the lead up to this. And everybody wanted to be a part of it. And they said, but have you spoken to so-and-so? Because they'll want to be part. And before I knew it, we had the Jewish Federations of North America reaching out to across all the federations of North America, the OU, the United Synagogue, LSJS, YU. In South Africa, we're working with the Chief Rabbi's office. And we've got over 100 communities, organizations, and schools, over 15 countries who have signed up to honor Rabbi Sacks in this way. And as we've sort of said, he loved learning from conversations. And I'm hoping that the conversations that he started will continue in these communities, in these organizations around the world. We have a web page dedicated to it. And I hope that we will have a schedule of all the events that are taking place that you can join remotely in the next few hours.
Yeah, and I know there's various resources that you've created especially for the Communities and Conversation program available on the Legacy Trust's website. One of the things about Lord Sacks, though, Jonah, if I can ask you your final question, was that he was very technologically engaged. So you've got resources that he's created, whether it be the cartoons, the animations, or social media activity and so on. But in the same way as I guess we think about when it comes to Holocaust survivors and keeping their memory alive and keeping the lessons that they've taught us going for future generations, there's nothing like having the man or the people in front of you. So you're facing a massive challenge. Can you tell us about maybe how your thinking has developed over the last year about how that can be achieved going forward?
I think that that his words of wisdom are still going to have the same, maybe not the same, but a level of impact even when he's not with us. I think the messages and the teachings that he espoused are going to be needed for generations to come. And to that effect, the Rabbi Sacks Legacy Trust have some key priorities and projects going forward. Number one, to make his teachings and his ideas as accessible as we can. So we're creating a brand new website that will be an archive of everything. And he was incredibly prolific. So we're trying to make sure that we ingest absolutely everything that we possibly can. We want to translate as much of his material into Hebrew as our priority, into Spanish and perhaps Russian. Bring back any of his publications that are out of print at the moment. And a lot of them are in production and being translated into various different languages as we speak. And of course, partnerships with the organizations with whom he worked over the years. So those are the main areas right now. But as you said, he felt that every new technology needed to be used to maximize his teachings and to share his Torah with the world, and for us to be able to use every single option that we had at our fingertips. And I hope that we'll be able to continue to do that.
Okay. One more thing for Rabbi Goldstein and then Alan will conclude. Did you ever have a conversation with Lord Sacks about what he still felt he hadn't achieved, perhaps what he wanted to achieve? I mean, he had done such a huge amount for the community, for the world. Did you ever have that conversation about what was still to come?
I think that, that obviously, one project we know that was in the works and something that I think, was a great loss that it wasn't completed was obviously the commentary that he was working on Chumash. And I think, to me, it's not about one specific project or another. It's exactly as Joanna said. He was a person of tremendous creativity and drive to do good that, in a sense, it wasn't about one thing or another thing. He was creating all the time and he was so prolific. And I think that's also something that we can all learn from him. There's really a sense in life that we don't stop, and we mustn't stop, and none of us must, because life is too short and it's too precious. And he created so much. If you think about what he created in the written word and the spoken word and the impact that he made in the world, it's astonishing that that could be achieved in one lifetime. If he had lived for another 10 and 20 and 30 years, how much more would have been created? It's incalculable what would have been created. So I think in that sense, and he wanted to, I mean, he was, as Joanna said, and that's how my experience of him as well was that he was constantly looking for chiddush, for new things and new ideas and new book projects and new ways of getting the word of Torah out into the world. And I think at a moment of a Yahrzeit, we need to reflect not only on what he did, but say, what is that message to us? So, you know, if I were to sort of sum up sort of concluding remarks from this in this discussion, it would be, you know, we should learn from his relentless pursuit of excellence, his relentless pursuit of innovation, of doing good, of compassion, of empathy, of the will to make this world into a better place as a partner with Hashem. You know, that beautiful phrase in the Midrash, to be a shutaf l'Kadosh Baruch Hu b'mayse bereishit, to be a true partner with God in creation. In a certain sense, this Yahrzeit is a moment of reflection that I think, and I would say this, you know, both within the context of Anglo-Jewry, but world Jewry as well, it is a call to action. This Yahrzeit is a call to action of every Jew around the world to say, how can I become better? What more can I do? How can I continue to make this enormous contribution and be part and be a partner with Hashem and creation, and to do that in the merit of Rabbi Sacks Zatzal, that it should be Le'ilui Nishmato. I want to wish Alan Arichut Yamim, long life, and of course to the entire family, to Elaine and their children and grandchildren, and to you too, Joanna, who was a Talmidah and at the right hand of Rabbi Sacks, to you too, Arichut Yamim, and to be truthful, it's actually Arichut Yamim to all of Am Yisrael, because indeed, all of Am Yisrael are Avelim for his, are mourners for his passing. May his memory be a blessing, Yezichro Baruch.
Thank you. And Alan, if I can give you the final words. If someone was arriving from the planet Mars onto Earth this weekend, and they heard about the Yahrzeit of this person, Lord Rabbi Sacks, what would be the one thing that you'd want them to know?
Oh, I would want them to realize that it's the role of a Jew to be loyal to his people and to behave in a dignified, cultured manner. And if you're looking for somebody who embodies the notion of Kiddush Hashem, somebody who understands all of the culture and philosophy of Western civilization and yet views it all through a Jewish lens, and when he enters the room, people say, wow, this must be an impressive people that can produce a man like this, then this is Rabbi Jonathan Sacks. Over the last year, I lost a brother but gained a giant, because with perspective, I've seen how huge his personality was, how he dealt with things at the greatest level of intellectual achievement, and at the same time made time for everybody on every small issue, and always with dignity. And you want to say, here is a fine Jewish person who mastered the chokhmah of the world that we live in and understood the spirituality of the Jewish religion and its history and tradition. If you want a role model to follow, difficult as it is to follow that role model, here, Mr. Martian, this is the man you have to put.
And just very last thing, you've said there that you didn't necessarily fully appreciate at the time quite how much perhaps his impact was and how widespread it was. Is there something that you would want to say to your brother, perhaps, that you didn't get a chance to say?
I think we had a really good bond. I don't think we left things unsaid, but it is true, my late father used to use a phrase, no man is a hero to his butler. We have in Hebrew an expression, Ein Navi Be'iro, there's no prophet in his own city. When you're that close to somebody, you don't stand back in awe. You tease them when he comes down from giving an amazing keynote address. You don't bow down. You tease him about something or other. So yes, we used to have a teasing relationship. And he knows, I don't use it in the past tense, he knows how close he was to all of his family, how he was interested in all his family. So yes, we were close and we were intimate. We didn't worship him, we admired him. So I don't think there was anything left unsaid. But as I say, with the distance, with a perspective, you just realize how wide his influence was, how his Jewish message had universal resonance, and how from New Zealand to Palo Alto, from as Joanna is organizing this global day, his reach was global, Jewish and non-Jewish. He knew what he'd achieved, and I don't think he left anything undone. I think his message would be, okay, I've done my bit, now you carry on.
Thank you very much, Alan. As I said, wish you and the family long life. Thank you very much to Chief Rabbi Goldstein, to Alan Sachs, and to Joanna Ben-Arosh for joining me.
And that's it for this edition of the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy. Through its partners, GPG is working to support the growth of Jewish community life in the UK and worldwide. To find out more, visit www.gpg.org. All that's left for me to do is to thank our guests, our production team Leo Mendel and Adam Bradley, and you for listening. Please do subscribe to the show in your podcast application. That way you'll hear any previous episode or be informed when new episodes become available. Don't forget that for more information on any of the stories we've featured, you can always go to jewishnews.co.uk. If you'd like to comment, then we'd love to hear from you on editorial@thejngroup.com. That's editorial@thejngroup.com. From me, Justin Cohen, do join us next time here on the Jewish News Podcast. Goodbye.